Welcome to what, as it turns out, will be a double feature during this hour, a lecture on, a lecture-ish kind of thing on poetry and ineffability, and then at 7:30, some poetry readings by Richard Curry, who will read from his work Patter, and he will also host readings by Drake students, from the Coalition of Black Students, and also from Run PSN. And if that's not enough, tomorrow night is the opening event for our Ineffability exhibition, artwork, poetry, and music about the inability to say anything. That'll be starting at 5 p.m. In the Fine Arts Center, first in the Weeks Gallery and then Anderson Gallery, and ending up at 7:30 p.m. in Cheslow Auditorium for a jazz sax quartet performance. So I'm here right now just to introduce the first of these events, the lecture on poetry and ineffability. My name is Tim Knepper. I teach philosophy and religion here and direct a comparison project. The comparison project does a number of different things. One thing we do is an annual series of lectures and dialogues and special events on a single topic that we explore comparatively through the perspective of different religious traditions. And in this case, also through art, music, poetry, and literature. Our theme for last year and this year is ineffability, which is a big word for that which you can't talk about, the failure and limits of language in religion. And to get a better view of how it works in religious traditions, we wanted to look at related areas of inquiry and performance, hence we've done lectures on music and visual arts already. Tonight we'll have a lecture on poetry, and next semester we'll have a lecture on Samuel Beckett. We're generously funded by six sources. I want to thank them all: Drake's Humanities Center, Drake's Principal Financial Group Center for Global Citizenship, Humanities Iowa, the Medbury Fund, the Des Moines Area Religious Council, and Cultivating Compassion, the Richard Deming Foundation. One of our funders, Humanities Iowa, asked us to take attendance at our events. To that end, I will pass around the binder. Many of you already know the drill. Write your names, if nothing more, to let us know how many folks are here. If you want to be added to our emailing list or Humanities Iowa's emailing list, there's a place to write your email address and check the appropriate box. If you're not getting our emails, that's because I didn't read your handwriting, so please give it to me again. There's not quite enough space on these. We need to do something about that in the future.
There's a pen inside there.
I also want to thank some other people who helped make this event possible. The colleague Leah Townsend, Carla Hurling, our administrative assistant, and Aaron Mercurio, our research assistant. We're taking some time off after all these events. Our next event won't be until February 12th. We're going to be recuperating, like my favorite character from the children's book, Old Bear. When I come back out again, it will be spring. One thing actually we're going to do over the hiatus is figure out what our theme will be for the next programming year. Violence in religion is a topic that's been proposed. Food in religion is a topic that's been proposed. And engaged religion is a topic that's been proposed. If you have any thoughts about any of those or other topics, please let me know. So for tonight, a lecture-ish thing, a meditation, on the way certain poets create aesthetic experiences by simultaneously constructing and undermining their own linguistic creations, entitled Using a Net to Catch the Air, Poetry, Ineffability, and Small Stones in a Shoe. Christopher Janke is our lecture-ish person tonight. Chris is a jack of all trades, or a man of many talents. He's a poet. He has an MFA in creative writing, modern and postmodern literature, and arts administration from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's published more than 80 poems in dozens of different journals, including Harper's, the American Poetry Review, Field Fence, A Public Space, Diagram, Plowshares, and so forth. His first collection of poems won the Fence Modern Poets Series Prize. That's called Structure of the Embryonic Rat Brain. And he also has a two-volume set of poetry called Blink Song coming out next year from, do I just read the letters? H-N-G-M-N Books? Oh, yeah! Boy, I'm so stupid. Chris is also a visual artist. His entree into this field happened last year. It was an exhibition entitled How the World Wears Its Words. It explored the relationship between word and world in a way that was said to, quote, obliterate the distinction between, actually, I'm a bit more paraphrasing than quoting, so leave the quote out. Obliterate the distinction between temporal words and spatial art. Said to obliterate the distinction between temporal words and spatial art. Chris is also an entrepreneur. He is the co-founder, vice president, and senior editor for Slope Publications, a publisher of books of poetry that publishes 2 to 3 books a year, and also hosts meetings and bestows awards. Not to mention the fact that he is the owner of a restaurant, bar, apartment building, laundromat, soon the entire field of Turner's Falls in quaint little Western Massachusetts. Chris is also, I think, my oldest, dearest friend in the world. I hail from Massachusetts, more or less, and since moving to Iowa in 2002, in Des Moines, in 2005, we don't get back east as much, all that often. Usually we do in the winter and get out to see them in snow in Western Mass. I think it was about 3 years ago that I saw these funny little objects on Chris's wall that involved poems where words had been cut out and there was string attaching the relationship between words and so forth. And that started a really interesting discussion between us about something I research in religion, ineffability, and his own efforts to, I guess, perform ineffability. So delighted to have you here, Chris. Please join me in welcoming Christopher Janke.
Can you hear me if I speak with the microphone that far away? If I overproject, you can either leave or raise your arms. I'll hear the feedback. I did a large print version, a small print version. I'm going to try the small print version until I stumble too much. I'm a poet, I'm used to the form, the shape of it on the page, and so I've become accustomed to just reading it with the indentations and line breaks. And when I expanded the typeface, it doesn't look right. It doesn't matter to you, I suppose, but it matters to me. Thanks, Tim. Thanks, Drake. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to Comparison Project, which I think is doing amazing stuff. Tim and I have been talking a little bit about what things the Comparison Project does, what things are outside its scope. And it seems to me really important work that has application all over. And I want to thank the Dumbbell Nebula, which is directly above our heads. It's 1,360 light years away and 1.44 light years across. Moving, but it's above our heads right now. One, the ineffable is that which can't be described. I should point out the obvious here. I'm here, there's a microphone, I plan to describe. With words, I'm not going to dance, I'm not going to mime, I might gesture, I will probably point. I'd also be remiss if I didn't explain that I'm speaking as a poet tonight more than as a scholar. That isn't to say that this lecture won't contain categorization, analysis, scrutiny, reference, history, all the things by which scholars judge themselves. But it is to say that my end may not be the scholar's end. My aim, perhaps not the scholar's aim, because my target is perhaps not the scholar's target. In other words, I'm going to talk about poetry and ineffability. I'm a poet. You've given me a microphone. I hope somebody warned you. Two, every word implies each word it is not. The way that each shape implies every other shape. For by shape, we mean the thing interrupting space. And by a word, we mean the thing interrupting continuity. What kind of continuity? Continuity of apparent perception? fluidity of apprehension, to break into parcel, from one to many by virtue of the first. Does a word add information to a scene or break a scene into bits? Small cultural bits, imaginative bits, bits of perception, integers of social significance. We move from analog to digital as we move into the word. What is color? The thing that comes with shape, though I admit that is beside the point. What's a word? The thing that comes with a world. Well, our world anyway, our cultured, inherited world. But what's a world? The thing that comes with consciousness. Here I'm agreeing with contemporary German philosopher Thomas Metzinger that consciousness is having a world, or more precisely, it's having the appearance of one. Three, just what do we mean by describe? Again, just what do we mean by describe? 4A. Just as you can sit around a table and collectively eat, but you can't cross-nourish, that is, the food I eat at our shared table will not nourish your body, in just this way, we can sit around and talk or listen or eat together, but to take in a word, you do it alone. I can't consume it for you, and the word is not destroyed by your consumption of it. There are some who say, though, that you become consumed by it, and by the world that comes with its perspective. And if not consumed, then developed by it. Unlike food, which takes on your shape, the word causes you to adopt its own form. 4B. In fact, a word is only a word when it becomes dis and re-embodied. That is, when a dog looks at a newspaper, there are no words. If the world suddenly lost all of its human, would there be words? If you wanted to kill a word, how exactly would you do it? We could take a word we wish to kill and grab it when it's not looking while it's at Burger King and hustle it out, wrap it in a rug, and stuff it in the trunk. Drive it over a cliff and hope no one notices that the word has disappeared from the lexicon. Can you round up every instance, every reference, and all substitute synonyms? What if the synonyms are really too close to the original word? That is, what if the concept itself is the problem? Or to put it a different way, what if we engraved a word onto stone, and the stone were discovered 2 million years from now by a human, long after English has been lost to history, and some human finds the stone and brings it to a university where the scholars find it intriguing, but ultimately indecipherable. This is 2 million years from now. Is it still a word? Does it retain its wordness as long as we have hope that someone might decipher it? Someone might see the sign, not just as a sign, but as the sign? And how would they know when they got it right, without thousands of comparative texts to gauge nuance and usage? What if the scholar could find a rock and determine that on it is an amazing carving, a kind of relief, a word for which they have no understanding, until it is much later deciphered? And what if actually what they thought was a word was simply a turd? Does the word then lose its wordiness, become a decorative etching when we give up hope? Or is it always a word waiting to be rediscovered? What about when there are no more humans? Is the word carved into stone a word? And the word on the stone, what should it be? Stone? No. Word? No. Chair? No. Ineffable? All right. Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. Four C. What is clarity? Can clarity ever obscure? Does revealing a truth ever obscure another? Hitler was a cute baby, too. We speak to each other and to ourselves in a shorthand's shorthand. Five. Okay, more questions. A. Donald Rumsfeld? Reprise. Just what do we mean by describe? B. Why should we assume the world is describable? Convenience? Habit? Experience? C. What's the source of the best descriptions? D. A satisfactory description. An accurate description. A reasonable description. A full description of the events. A possible description. A working description. A working definition. A dictionary definition. A street definition. The Venn diagram of all definitions. The Venn diagram of all descriptions. And all the things outside it. E. All the things destroyed by description. All the descriptions that destroy what they describe. The movie version of the book. The moment you tried to articulate your displeasure with your mate and only made him mad. Trying to figure out why you hate your waiter, though he's very nice and efficient and clean. The legal definition of anything. All the descriptions destroyed by things. All the things we could have described but did not because they happened not to be. Unending description. All the words that have an origin outside material experience. Like, chair? Sky? Soul? F. To what end is a good description? Is a bad description still a description? What about an inaccurate description? Why? Just look at that. That dog is a cat. I mean, that cat is a dog. The room was filled with nothing. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was a worm. What is the minimum criteria to describe? Is repeatability needed? Isn't it both necessary and impossible? What about pointing at something? And that is, what about pointing at the wrong thing? 6. This may seem like an aside, but it isn't. I wonder how many of you have kept up on the controversy surrounding the word literally. Recently, some writers in Salon and elsewhere have been complaining about the definition in Merriam-Webster of the word literally. One definition for literally is, quote, in effect, colon, virtually. In other words, the word literally sometimes means figuratively. In other words, it's okay to say it literally rained cats and dogs. It's even okay with the dictionary. The controversy is, as you have probably guessed or already aware, that we think of literally as meaning actually. This is a big deal for a lot of writers. Writers who like to be precise, who like to think of using the word literally, for emphasis degrades our language by eroding the borders between distinctions. Of course, Merriam-Webster says they simply define words as they see them used. If, for example, James Joyce uses literally to mean figuratively, and he does, then they figure, and I wholeheartedly agree, that they'd better enter that as a usage, as a definition, in their big book. They add a note saying, quote, since some people take sense two to be the opposite of sense one, it has been frequently criticized as a misuse. Instead, the use is pure hyperbole intended to gain emphasis. And this is their critique. But it often appears in context where no additional emphasis is necessary. I find all this very interesting, but I can think of very few examples where I would get the meaning confused. In a recent Facebook spat with a former bandmate about this, he said he found the definition dismaying, and he said it makes the following sentence too confusing. Quote, I laughed so hard I literally shit myself. I suggested that any confusion about that sentence derives mostly from the people he hangs out with. You see, the curious thing to me about this hubbub is not that the word literally can be used to mean its supposed opposite. I mean, I think that's cool, actually. It joins an elite club of words called contronyms. Cleave. Fix. Think text. Continue. Think official meeting. Or dust. Think crops. Think dining. But what's interesting to me about all this arguing and wringing of hands is something different. Let's think about this word literally. The word literally, at its root, does not come from a reference to the real or from referencing the actual. Originally, the word literal referred to a reference to Scripture, to the Bible. We can see from the form of the word, at its root, it is about words. It refers to the wordness of a thing. So why, then, hasn't literal meant of or relating to the use of a word? That is, why do we use a word about words to mean actual? It probably stems from the biblical use. Then, too, might be our entire treatment of words. In my thinking, a literal thing is a thing that happens within words. If it happened literally, it happened within a worded description. When did we decide that our words are actual? How closely we hold this notion that the word is its thing. How often we confuse them. Our thinking depends on it. Perhaps our sanity. Allow me to continue to interrupt our mutual sanity, such as it is, for a bit. When you look up a word in the dictionary, are you looking up to see a record of how the word is used, or are you looking up to see what the thing is? It's too bad that our words don't have a one-to-one relationship to the world, or that's what the scientist, the analytical philosopher would say. But the poet might say it's a lucky break. But maybe she would say it's a break that's not from luck at all. C6H12O6 plus 6O2 equals 6CO2 plus 6H2O plus energy. Minus bracket minus C6H10O6 minus close bracket minus N plus N parentheses H2O yields N parentheses C6H12O6 plus 1/2 O2 N. That was 7. Here comes 8. Let's get to some poems. I stepped from plank to plank, a slow and cautious way, the stars about my head, I felt about my feet the sea. I knew not but the next would be my final inch. This gave me that precarious gait some call experience. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like a stillness in the air between the heavens and the storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering firm for that last onset. When the king be witnessed in the room, I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portion of me be assignable. And then it was there interposed a fly with blue, uncertain stumbling buzz between the light and me. And then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see. The brain is wider than the sky, or put them side by side. The one the other will contain with ease, and you beside. The brain is deeper than the sea, for hold them blue to blue, the one the other will absorb as sponges buckets do. The brain is just the weight of God, or heft them, pound for pound, and they will differ, if they do, as syllable from sound. I'm just using poems to establish a lineage here. I'm intentionally using poems you know or may know, and they're all written before 1953, well before, in this case. I do have a point I'm making. A point I'm making, I think, is more strongly made when I use work that's familiar or canonical. Tiger, tiger, burning bright, in deep forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? The difficulty to think at the end of day, when the shapeless shadow covers the sun, and nothing is left except light on your fur. There was the cat slopping its milk all day. Fat cat, red tongue, green mind, white milk, in August, the most peaceful month. to be in the grass in the peacefulest time without that monument of cat, the cat forgotten the moon, and to feel that the light is a rabbit light in which everything is meant for you and nothing need be explained. Then there is nothing to think of. It comes of itself. And east rushes west, and west rushes down, no matter. The grass is full and full of yourself. The trees around are for you. The whole of the wideness of the night is for you, a self that touches all edges. You become a self that fills the four corners of night. The red cat hides away in the fur light, and there you are, humped high, humped up. You are humped higher and higher, black as stone. You sit with your head like a carving in space, and the little green cat, the bug in the grass. 9. Once more, the ineffable is that which is indescribable. Just what do we mean by describe? And now I am confused. Are we talking about words or talking about the world when we talk about description? There are those who, to put it simply, say that if we call a thing ineffable, we have removed it from the very category into which we were trying to place it. We've described it as indescribable. In fact, to simply name a thing, to refer to a thing, is to give a description. If you have effectively communicated, even within yourself, that a thing is a thing, you have created a description, minimal perhaps, but there a delineation is made. A thing is pointed to. This renders all things not ineffable, but, well, effable, if you'll pardon my French. With this view, everything is effed as soon as it is named, or just before it gets given a name. If you say a thing is ineffable, it therefore is not. As a matter of fact, if we say a thing is a thing, we've supplied a description. If the it can be an it, it's been effed. Any mutual pointing at a thing separates it from its background, and that's a description. Are we simply saying, in this view, that only things that remain outside perception can be ineffable? Not just beyond language, but beyond perception? And as a thing is effed, what does that look like? As I wake and take in the world and gather a thought about the world, eventually to speak, at what point did I minimally describe any part of my world? Are the only things ineffable all the things that have never been thought of? Which, if we think about it, could either be a hell of a lot of things, if we, as a species, are not very busy thinking of what really is, or it could be very few things, with all the billions of thoughts we are all having. I wonder if anyone else right now is thinking of the mental states of all 7 billion human inhabitants of the planet. Did I just F them all? The entire mental contents of the planet? By giving it a name? Perhaps I can describe everything by simply saying, everything. What if I say everything that is, and everything outside that previous description? Everything I can think of, and everything I can't. To call those descriptions seems somehow wrong. I mean, I better love you too much to say how much I love you. If I don't, would you still call it love? If I can actually count and elucidate the precise ways, if it becomes a finite list? But what about a poet? Doesn't the poet describe love adequately? Isn't that why we love a poem, because it gets it right? But then again, this chair is so much a chair that I can't even say how cherry it is. OMG, this is such a cherry chair. It has cherry legs and a cherry back. Though, maybe I can think of a cherrier chair. One that was more like a true chair. It does have four legs. Or are they just acting like legs? Are they just subsumed into the matrix of chairness. Maybe it's hardly a chair at all. It's just assembled pieces made to look and act like a chair. What if we ground it into shards and made it into particle board, and then made it into an object to sit on that had four legs? Would it be more of a chair? Less of a chair? A chair could hardly be chairier now. 10. A moment ago, I read some scientific formula. Read one for the ripening of fruit, and read one for breathing. Are those descriptions? Are they accurate? Instead of sitting down and focusing on my breathing as one does in meditation and contemplative prayer, does this formula, this description, somehow suffice instead? 11. So if we say to name a thing is to render it described and therefore describable, if everything we call ineffable isn't by virtue of having called it such, the only place left to look for the ineffable, if we are foolish to think it exists in all the things that haven't been called ineffable, to look for the ineffable where it wouldn't be suspected, to look only at the things that are adequately described, to look at the things that are over-described. We must use description to upend description. The best way to avoid spontaneous combustion is to light everything on fire. This is called poetry. 12. The point I think I want to make is that every description, every pointing to that we consider adequate is not only contingent on our context and on our expectations for the mode of description we think appropriate for that moment, but is also about our ability to stop our curiosity. The poet is saying that even pointing, even scientific description, is a summation, is a kind of error. The adequate description, allowing the emotional response of familiarity to soothe us with and into a fiction. It's about taking in like a meal something that feels like it describes an essence. The problem is that essence is fiction. Essence is our way of summarizing, valuing, reducing. Description is about curiosity and the satisfaction thereof. A good description is a dismissal, a way to relieve the mind of its burden so it can go about helping the body find food, shelter, and sex. A rose by any other name is a sunrise. The way the day unfurls and exposes itself, the way the world does. What is at stake in our descriptions? A commitment to perspective? To the affirmation of our suspicions, perhaps? How does a new idea come about then? Should I say breathing is an involuntary muscle exercise? Should I say I can feel your breath on my cheek? Cause and effect, too, is something we carry. 13 ways of looking at a blackbird. Oh, thin men of Haddam, why do you imagine golden birds? Do you not see how the blackbird walks around the feet of the women about you? 24 blackbirds baked in pie. The most mystical experience is always the one right now. To describe it is to destroy it. 13. What about poetry? What about poets? Isn't the poet driving you towards the satisfaction? There's the trope of the sigh in the poetry reading. Isn't that what the poet wants? Emily Dickinson herself said, though, that she was not looking for a sigh of relief, but, of course, for the feeling of her head, the feeling that the top of her head had been blown off. Am I espousing a Humean view or a Kantian one, since it admits science a place? Am I saying there's a kind of language of being something at hand emotionally? I am saying that there are poems that are at once trying to do two things. One, trying to F the previously ineffed. They are trying to create a repeatable description of a heretofore unknown experience. Using words to create, and I'm admitting that that creation comes of a kind of description. It becomes a description of itself, and it refers to the world, and it refers to the world within a social context full of contingent and constructive meanings, yes, all that. And I'm saying that poems of a particular kind also do too. Through various tropes, sometimes through direct reference, and sometimes through slant usage, and sometimes through odd capitalization, they're shifting the linguistic ground we stand on. Ground we take as actual when it is merely literal. The words we use to explain everything to ourselves, these words are shifted. Am I just saying that poets make it new, that modernist mantra? No. Am I saying we just poets shift our perspective? Thinking cubism here? I don't think so. To get nearer to what I'm trying to say, I want to observe that in this case, the word perspective is metaphorical. I mean something more peculiar than an angle on an object, more encompassing than a worldview or ethos. I mean to observe that when one shifts from perspective to perspective, that in the shifting, there's a disorientation. As if stepping down from the street, one realizes, stepping down the street, one realizes that between the pavement panels, each crack opens to a different world. A glimpse of sun, or of a face, or of a chasm, or a moment showing through the cracks of language. To realize for a moment that we are the proverbial wily coyote who has run so fast and so hard onto an imaginary road that he is suspended in midair, only by his imagination. This is our reliance on a world knit of words, when we see briefly that, like matter, the world of words is made mostly of empty space. We, of course, are caught by another net of words when we drop down towards the far distant floor of the canyon. Though I don't doubt that there are those who plumb the depths through Vipassana, who perhaps find that there is no floor and just enjoy the endless falling, skydiving into a void. These poems want it both ways, to put into words that which cannot be put into words and thereby ineff the ineffable, but to retain the mystery, and thereby hold that the description is not complete, that description is somehow false. To satisfy the emotion with description without ending the hunger, without feeling like the question has been answered, to heighten mystery while describing truly. It's a description that hollows out the definition so there's a hole in the middle. But with all of this, we haven't addressed a key issue. Here this comes the sigh. What about the opposition between description and wonder? Is it necessary? Is it inevitable? Haven't we all experienced the sensation of knowing how an illusion is made, how the magic trick is done, and the wonder fades, the mystery is gone? Does an adequate description, when we encounter it, not only overwhelm our wonder, but reveal the wonder as a kind of ignorance, a kind of naivete? There's a kind of art criticism that focuses on technique, and now there are fields of research dedicated to the brain's reaction to art, to metaphor. Do these threaten to deflate our very meaning? You can poke a brain and elicit a memory. There is a sense in which knowing the historical traditions of the story of Jesus can undermine one's faith in it. Jesus becomes less magical, or perhaps merely magical, merely literary, to some, when they study the literary precedents for the stories that precede the one about the Nazarene. Does the description of the magic trick reveal that the ineffable is a flawed idea, that wonder is some kind of category error? No. In the end, wonder is about vastness. And description does not have to deny vastness. What denies vastness is our mental models. We allow description to stand in for the experience of the real thing. We have to in order to function. But we accept that as fact rather than as metaphor. We accept as actual rather than literal. Poets know that just zooming in or zooming out changes everything. Renders description inadequate, shifts the laws by which we calculate, Newtonian to quantum mechanics. So though cause and effect should always be held in strange relation, and though much of the world can be encountered with adequate description, The vastness and our relation to it are always present. So science is not an error, neither is wonder. 15. The world is so much bigger than you, and yet, whatever evidence there was for a world without you, you have now destroyed. To use a word is to place oneself inside a model of the world. The poet who sees this as a problem builds of the world a little snow globe. A safe place to stand or sit and observe the confusing world. The poet asks you to come into the cozy house for a cup of cocoa, and then hurls the globe with both of you inside it across the room, across the sky. There are poets, not only poets, who do this. They're just swinging their arms wide. Their fingers are outstretched. They're using a net to catch the air.
Who's going to ask the first question to that? You vying for who's going to get to ask the first question?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yep. I will ask a question.
Thanks,
I'm vibe to do so. I'm curious about the relationship between the poet and the historian, which to me is, at least within what you've read, is in congruous with landscape.
Mm-hmm.
By virtue of the poet enacts the ineffable by virtue of language, mm-hmm. which itself is, you know, how does one tie down language, right?
Yeah.
But you tend to create these verses, and I'm curious how you're working through this logic, that basically construct a history of the ineffable. And so it seems to me like a contradictory logic, but I'm curious how you are working through that.
Yeah. I think the major point I'm making is that there's a set of techniques, and there's a long tradition of really trying to question the way that words refer to the world within poetry. And I think it's different than usage. I think we can look at lots of different poets and say whether they do it or how often they do it. I like a lot of Robert Frost's poems. I don't think he's someone who uses these kinds of techniques I'm talking about. I think Emily Dickinson does. You know, and I'm not trying to make a major divide. So I'm thinking of it as a strain, a philosophical strain within poetry, maybe. But in relation to the historian, what do I say? What do I want to say about historians? I don't know if I want to say anything about historians. I think that narrative is provisional. I think that when you're writing a history, even the history of this event, if you were to write it, to be a complete description, you would never stop writing.
But is it an event?
I don't have an answer to that. right.
I mean, is it this kind of like relationship between language and that's always kind of in flux, especially given like cultures meshing and all this stuff, and I'm just kind of curious about the structure of your collection with regard to these like really palpable like definitional sections,
mm-hmm.
that go.
You mean within the writing, this writing that I just read?
I'm really curious how that reads. Like, how do you? Why? What's the logic for writers in this like auditorium?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what such as it is?
Mm-hmm.
How does that operate? Like, how did you decide to organize that?
So process-wise, I think in all of my compositions, whether they're poems or essays, I tend to do a lot of writing outside what I think is eventually going to be a piece. And in this case, I did a lot of, you know, Tim and I have talked for years about these kinds of issues, and I interrogated Tim a little bit about how he sees some of these issues, and then incorporated some of those positions, probably bastardized as a kind of foil in order to play against or to poke at. I think there are many different kinds of logic or arguments, and I think that there are lots of ways in which poetic speech can make a point more directly even than a logical.
And your installations, were you not able to show your installations? They are awesome.
Oh, well, I've got, so come tomorrow night. There's some up in the Weeks Gallery, and I've got some
displays
there.
They make like palpable what you do, just so awesome. I traced all that you did, just amazing. It was like, I don't know, those plexiglass studies. Can you explain this a little bit? How they relate to this project?
Sure.
I'm not sure.
I talk about these from time to time, and sometimes it takes a long time trying to find a quick answer.
That was so wordy.
Yeah.
I'll give you
a question about process and give you a process-based answer. I started by making these diagrams on top of poems. I wrote a very difficult poem, no punctuation, block of text. Really, I really enjoyed it. I really understood that it was going to be dense for anyone to encounter. And I started layering pages of vellum on top of it and finding poems within the poem, just tracing certain different words. It's like, oh, that's an interesting poem that I didn't notice was there. Oh, here's another one. And then I said, oh, what if I did some drawings here? And before I knew it, I was layering drawings and reinterpreting the poem as a drawing. I treated all the O's as if they were mountain peaks and then shaded in and drew a little village nearby. So, oh, that's an interesting way to read that poem. It's just O's. The poems were called of the O. So there's a lot of O's and about an obsession with what it means for a thing to be of a thing. So as I was working on these plexiglass books that I was hand-making, I was looking through them. I hung them on my window, my living room where I work, and I looked outside and said, there's a tree outside. How come this poem has nothing to do with that tree? I got really frustrated. I said, well, I'm going to start writing poems on plexiglass that refer to what I see through them. And that started a very, I'm working on this now, about what it means for the world to constrain a writing. What is the ultimate constraint of writing? What does it mean? If our words don't relate to the world, that's a problem, right? But if they only come from the world, we often see that as a problem too. So, and there's so many ways in which just our, I think even our prepositional use within casual language points to these embedded narratives that make no sense when you put them up against each other. Cause and effect, where things are going, eternity, love, you know, all these ideas that when you pile them together, I'm trying to bump them into each other so that the way in which I think they are problems to each other is apparent, not with any kind of answer, just because I find it really intriguing.
Thanks, Dan.
Hi.
Was there someone else? Why do we think ineffability is vast? Why do we think it's immense? Why is it not just the space between the next utterance?
I guess I would, my sense is that the history of its use is that it comes out of trying to refer to something that's ultimate. Something that is bigger, greater than is a term that is in some certain dictionary definitions. So I don't.
We don't know that it is and that words come out of a void and return to a void. We don't actually know that.
No, I don't know that. I know very little. I certainly don't know that. I find the space between the common things to be as large as the space between uncommon things.
Interestingly, it may be that it began as what you were not allowed to say, what you were prohibited from saying, and eventually the philosophers, the theologians got a hold of it and became what you can't talk about because it's ultimate.
There's a lot of taboo that relates to that too, in ways in which I feel like there are poets who are pushing that taboo as a way to try to refer to cross those definitions of ineffability. You know, talking about the taboo to push into this realm of otherwise not just forbidden but inaccessible.
As a scientist, I look at chemical formulas and things more or less like poetry, and they describe inadequately, but they do describe in a beautiful manner a lot of things.
Yeah. But I think mathematics is, you know, even in some ways even more that way, because you don't necessarily need a reference, I suppose. I don't think we think of the scientific formula as the meaning of a thing. It's the can explain the process. And the more precise you are, the narrower that scope has to be. It's almost by analogy that you get outside that.
It does trigger that a lot of times.
Oh, yeah. Well, the classic examples of Einstein, right, and the ways in which the mind not focusing on science creates a scientific answer that's completely counterintuitive, but then we name something that he says we should have named the exact opposite thing, right? You say the theory of relativity should be the theory of absoluteness because it's about the constancy of the speed of light, and not about the relativity of everything around it. Because he hated the way that had become a metaphor within contemporary society, and that everything became relative. But there's a power of language even within the scientific mind, with the scientific approach, which I think is metaphoric in a lot of ways. But I'm not a scientist, I would defer to the scientists. Hi.
First off, I want to say that it was a very eloquent lecture-ish that you gave.
Yeah, you can.
I guess my questions are more clarifying questions.
Okay.
The feeling that I was getting from your lecture was that words are very powerful. Is that correct?
I have a feeling that you are right now acting in the role of Socrates, and if I agree to this, I'm going to regret it in a few moments. But I'll say sure. I'll take the bait.
So then, are words powerful enough to completely convey another person's perspective? And if they are powerful enough, does that undermine perspective, or does that make it all more fascinating?
So there's a lot of assumptions embedded in the question. And I would probably take issue with some of the assumptions. In this context of this discussion, the word perspective escapes me. I have no idea what that means. Like, there's a perspective. Are we talking like perspective here? Drawing that line, recedes, those try to come together. Look at all those books, they're so much smaller down there. They're so much bigger up here. Is that what we mean by perspective? Because that is my perspective right now. But it's also my perspective that I think if I were to walk down there, these books would shrink. So there is a way in which that idea of perspective is difficult. And then the description of a perspective, and then the communication of the description of a perspective, all those are part of the question. And Your question is, are words powerful enough to do that?
I suppose what I'm trying to add, when I talk about perspective, I'm talking about it as a glimpse into another person's way of thinking, way of looking at life.
Can we communicate? Is that what you're asking? Is communication possible?
Is it possible to convey that completely with words?
What was the adjective? Is it possible to communicate?
To communicate completely with words.
I don't think so. Do you think so?
I wanted to know what you thought.
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I don't think I can communicate within myself completely anything. But that's just me. I mean, again, to bring it back to Socrates, I think that that Socratic method really illustrates in powerful form how our own explanations to ourself can be completely undone in a span of 5 minutes with a sensitive interlocutor, right? And I don't, you know, the solutions within those dialogues, such as they are also equally specious in many ways. So no. That's right.
Okay. Ineffability as grammatical rule that gets applied to anything we want to protect from language. Thoughts?
As a grammatical rule?
Yeah.
Because we
it's not a descriptor.
We
kind of a rule that governs the operation of things we want to protect from language.
It's too valuable to put into words.
Too valuable. Too precious.
Is it the excess?
Yeah, it could be excess.
So let's say love. Love's an example that I used, right? Love. But were we to allow it to be effed, we could eff it. Is that the question?
The question was just, would you agree with that position? Ineffability isn't so much a descriptor as it's a rule that gets applied to things that we want to protect in language. And I guess the question that comes after that is why do we want to protect things from language?
Yeah, I would say you're right. I mean, judging from the dictionary definition, I think both the taboo definition and the greater than language definition both seem like they're protective. So if that's the usage, that's a documentation of the usage, then yes. Why do we want to protect things from language?
And we've seen now for 2 years that this is a quite common move cross-culturally. What's so bad about language?
Well, okay, so love again, the love is, love within poetry is a thing. There's a lot of love poems, and they're within language. So you could say in a way that there's a piercing of that protective shield within the artistic form, that we allow it within that context. We allow it within religious contexts, right? In the contemporary Christian tradition, you talk about, you go back to the Greek, to the etymologies, the four kinds of love, to come up with agape, and there's a way in which language becomes very important there. But they're both, I mean, do we only allow it within semi-sacred spaces? So no, there's the counseling session, right? Where you peel apart dissect the love in order to figure out how it works. I don't know, is that a sacred space too? I mean, certainly, I was just looking at, there's a thesis over there. I'm sure there's a bunch of theses on the psychology of love here. Is the dissertation a sacred space?
Definitely not.
I was going to say, that's not my normal thinking of it, right? It's so often caricature is an abuse of language, right?
But if we think about the ineffable as that which cannot be articulated, literally is liminal space or liminal. That, I mean, belief. How does one articulate, I believe in something?
Well, the Apostles' Creed is how you, that is how it's been done, right? The, because you bring it down actually to words. And the performative utterance, the, you know, I do.
Austin, yeah.
I do, right? That's how you bring it into to words. Or you walk down the aisle. You know, that's, there's a transformation, but it involves words very often in these very important things.
It's a really, really smart point. That's the moment of the ineffable becoming concrete.
Yeah.
Well, it's through words.
Well, you can, I mean, it doesn't mean that you can't question, but that doesn't mean it's ineffable. It just means you're going through a ritual and you happen to both believe and that this thing called love is ineffable and that it can't be described, but really, you're just following your cultural traditions, right? There's a, there'd be a Marxist Lacanian definition of what you're actually doing within a material world that tries to strip a lot of those beliefs away. And that perspective can be very powerful and enlightening. The Marxists that I know, I don't know many Lacanians, but the Marxists that
I have
to go there. Yeah, but the Marxists that I know also seem to have some kind of belief in some kind of sacredness, the sacredness of the body, of work, of the relationship to the material world. I don't know how you know, mind is of course a problem in when you start going down to what is mind, how do you get a new idea, all that stuff. So, hi.
If you were hypothetically kind of extracted ineffability from the world, what do you think it would look like? Do you think it would get rid of a lot of the unrest in the world?
If I extracted ineffability from the world, so in other words, I took it out, I destroyed it, so ineffability was not around anymore.
Yeah.
So everything's describable.
I'm fully able to see things exactly how you would see them.
I see. Oh. Do I think communication eliminates difference? Do I think communication eliminates conflict that comes from difference? I don't think so. I mean, there are going to be a lot of people who disagree with me. And that is now a personal sense. I think that sometimes we can understand someone perfectly and really be angry with our perfect understanding of them, as far as we can get a perfect understanding, right? But I don't know. Answering this gentleman's question over here, I said that there was no perfect understanding, there's no complete understanding, even within the self. But, you know, in raising the scientific language in the talk, it's trying to show that there are different ways, we have different ways of talking about the same thing, and that we expect a certain mode of language, a certain mode of description is appropriate to a context, right? So, I have no idea what kinds of language they use in the peace talks in the Middle East. You know, what kind of, if we change that language, completely upended it, would we get different results? I don't know. This is far beyond my, we should walk in there with poetry or, you know, I don't know. Or scientific language. Would either one of them change the debate in a fundamental way? I think that sometimes conflicts come from similarity.
And you don't mean to suggest that ineffable is the same as incomprehensible.
My gut reaction is to say, no, I don't mean to suggest that, but I don't know, maybe, no, no.
That puts way too much power on words.
I think that I asked that question and I don't have an answer. That's incomprehensible to me or incomprehensible to all, I guess is the next, right? If it's incomprehensible to all, then it very well could be ineffable, I think.
That means the only things we understand are the things that we can put into words. That's what you're left with.
So this also starts the private language discussion. How do you, can you describe a thing to yourself without words? There are a lot, I think that a lot of the philosophical understandings that no, basically you can't. But if I wake up out of sorts after a dream I don't remember, and I wake up this next day out of sorts after a dream I don't remember, can those two things be related to one another without words? I don't know, they may be. But have I comprehended them? Or just experienced them? I think the idea of understanding a thing outside of language, I think that is a complicated notion. I think most of the ways that we think of understanding involve language.
It's complicated.
But a dog understands it's going to go get that ball that time after time after time.
Thank you.
Right. Thanks, everybody.